Five-O believed only in the moment-to-moment strategies of the realist. Five-O said,
"You mean that bugger you went tell about before?"
"You mean that bugger you were talking about before?"
"Yes." "Garens?"
"Guarantee it."
"Den tell dat bugger for bring me one hamburger wit mustard and one beer. Me, I no can move. I real had it."
That bugger. A scalding realization rolled through Conrad's skull. The book. The Stoics. His very lifeblood. Gone. For an instant he looked back at the remains of West Greystone to see if there might not be some way to retrieve it. Although, of course, there wasn't. But this was more than a book. This was living tissue. This was the word of Zeus. He looked forlornly across the infinite nightscape of the Livermore Valley.
"Uh-huh, brah," said Five-O.
"What's wrong, brother?"
"My book's gone, Five-O." "The book all about that bugger?"
Gloomily. "Yeah."
"I went spuck.
I've seen..."
"You read that book to the max. By now you get 'em memorized."
Conrad shook his head despondently, then looked at Five-O and said, "I'm going to take your advice. I'm going to bag it, Five-O. But where can I go? What can I do? Look at me. I don't have any clothes. I don't have any shoes. I'm covered in mud."
"Try use the head, brother."
Five-O said it wearily, as if talking to someone who was proving to be dense.
"Use my head? How you like fo' leave here, brother? In Santa Rita baggies and zoris like that?"
"How do you want to leave here, brother, in Santa Rita pajamas and rubber sandals?"
"Cannot. This the one night in your whole life you can run through the streets with no clothes on, covered in mud, and no more nobody going think you one crazy person. Oh, no. The Okies them. They going tell, poor little Howley, earthquake victim. We going help him. Garens. Garens, ball barons. Use the head. Bag it, brah. Hitchhike. The Okies them. They help you."
"But he said they're going to shoot anybody who goes near the fence."
"Ulai. They no get that many deputies. They try for scare you, man. They just sucking wind. Bag it."
Still down on his haunches, Conrad stared at the Hawaiian for a few seconds, then said, "What are you going to do?" Five-O smiled faintly.
"I going handle him. I always handle him."
Conrad stood up. He extended his hand toward Five-O and said, "Wish me luck." Five-O grasped his hand with both of his and held on tightly and looked up. The moonlight played over his mud-smeared face. He blinked, and his eyes misted over.
"You my brother, Conrad. You went save my life. Now beg it. Split. Laid us for these motherfucking Rotterdam and these motherfucking junk place."
Conrad straightened up and looked all about in the darkness. The generator continued to throb away. Flashlight beams and dim silhouettes were milling about over toward the parking lot. Sirens and horns could be heard in the distance to the south, in Pleasanton. And yet a heavy stillness had settled over the Livermore Valley and the hills that rose to the north. At one stroke, the earthquake had obliterated the electrical galaxies that had always lit up the night. It had brought back the stupendous presence of the moon, the stars, and the earth itself. The very floor of the world had moved, with a power that still resonated in the bones of everyone who had been through the upheaval. A cliff now ran straight through Santa Rita, where none had existed before. A new wave of fear and hopelessness swept Conrad's nervous system. He felt as if the very last roots of his past had been ripped out. Zeus had done all this, and he was in Zeus' hands. He gave Five-O one last smile and a little wave, and then began running alongside the escarpment, away from the remains of West Greystone. What could he do?
Hitchhike.
This vague notion was the only plan he had. try to reach Route 580 or Pleasanton, and hitchhike.
Where?
It didn't matter. Wasn't actually escaping from jail, just staying out of harm's way until... Until what, he didn't know. The ground hurt his feet as he ran. He hadn't run barefoot for a long time. He hadn't run at all for a long time. His lungs were already beginning to burn. The flesh of his back was beginning to hurt from where the lathing had cut into it. But fear and his pumping adrenaline overrode everything else. He kept running toward the highway, up ahead in the moonlight. Looked like huge, filthy marshmallows floating in the air. What were they? Now he could make it out. The earthquake had uprooted the razor-wire-topped cyclone fence when it created its new cliff. The marshmallows were the enormous concrete blocks with which the metal posts had been anchored in the ground. Beyond the fence was the steep embankment upon which Highway 580 had been built. But it was no longer level. There was an astonishing, jagged silhouette. The earthquake had thrust an entire section of the highway upward, until it was 8 or 10 feet above the other. He could see the beams of car lights. They were going nowhere. Then came the flashing lights and the wailing of a police cruiser approaching the stranded cars. So much for hitchhiking on Route 580. Conrad ducked under the upthrust fence and started running west, away from Santa Rita. A phrase popped up in his mind. Escaped convict. And yet it wasn't accurate. He was merely exercising his will to avoid. Rotto and the Nordic Bund would no doubt kill him, or try to. Zeus had given him this way out. Zeus had demolished Santa Rita and lifted up the very fence for his benefit. Of that he didn't have the slightest doubt. Lead me, O Zeus. He ran, leaping over ruts, hillocks, drain pipes, rocks, bottles, roots, shags of tulare grass, whatever rose up before him in the moonlight. Ahead? How far? A mile? Half a mile? He could see a galaxy of automobile lights that seemed to be moving about aimlessly. As he drew closer, he could hear car and truck engines accelerating. Shouts bawled out in the midst of it all. Shouts and frantic exhortations over a bullhorn. Conrad's first instinct was to avoid the place. Then he remembered Five-O's words.
"This is the one night in your whole life you can run through the streets with no clothes on, covered in mud, and no more nobody going think you one crazy person."
He was approaching some sort of parking area. Headlights came on and shot this way and that in the darkness, accompanied by great roars and squeals. People were yelling. Whatever this place was, all was uproar and confusion. The headlights hit long shapes and cast prodigious shadows. A barracks tilted precariously and about to collapse. Barracks. A prison. Like Santa Rita. But in the next instant he realized that couldn't be. No fence. No wall. He didn't know whether he was seeing things or not, but as the headlight beams swung this way and that, he seemed to keep getting glimpses of young men in underwear, men no older than himself, scampering about in the dizziest fashion. And here in the parking lot, he could now tell, were rows of jeeps, painted in camouflage patterns. A figure came running toward him. It was a man about 35 with close-cropped blonde hair, a long face, and a big nose, a real beak, hurriedly buttoning up a camouflage jumpsuit. Conrad ducked behind a jeep. The man bounded up into a jeep nearby. It roared to life. The headlight beams shot forth, revealing an ancient barracks building, now keeled over sidewise. Two young men were trying to climb into a window. One had on a T-shirt and boxer shorts. The other, only the shorts. Both were barefoot. The man with the big nose jumped out of the jeep, leaving the motor running and the lights on, and ran toward them. The lights of the jeep cast a long, crazy shadow ahead of him. "What do you idiots think you're doing?" he shouted. "We gotta get back inside, sir," said the young man with no T-shirt. "Our uniforms are in there." "Forget about it," yelled the man in the camouflage suit. "That goddamn thing's about to fall down. We've got enough casualties already. There's uniforms in J-23, J for Jonathan." "Yes, sir." The young men hurried off in the darkness. Shouts from all sides, over here, over there. Engines roaring to life, wheels churning, headlights shooting this way and that. Beams suddenly hit Conrad as he crouched behind the jeep. He stood up. He froze in his tracks. The man with the big nose, returning to his jeep, spotted him and barked out. "What's the matter with you, soldier? What are you doing?" Conrad's mind spun.
I fell, sir. I fell in a ditch."
"You fell in a ditch?" The man made it sound as if it were the most absurd thing he'd ever heard of. "Well, Jesus Christ, are you hurt?"
"No, sir."
"Then snap out of it. Get your uniform. What's your barracks?" Desperate, not knowing what else to do, Conrad pointed in the direction the two young men had gone and said,
"Right over there, sir."
"Then get over there, and pull yourself together." Conrad started running out of the parking lot. Set back from the lot was a low wooden sign, now illuminated by headlights. Camp Parks, U.S. Army Reserve Center. There were letters and numbers, apparently designating buildings. Soon he was amid long rows of barracks, flimsy wooden structures, many of which had been damaged by the earthquake and were tilted at precarious angles. Confusion and uproar reigned. Young men were running about, some in camouflage uniforms, but many in the underwear they had been sleeping in. Someone had got hold of a bullhorn and was bellowing out instructions that, thanks to screels of feedback, were utterly incomprehensible. Conrad could see two buildings lit up by generators, but most of the light now came from vehicles moving about on the edge. Raw glares and long, baffling shadows slid over the camp, over the skittering reservists, over the teetering barracks. A beam of light moved across a shed-like building.
J-23.
Conrad ran toward it. Inside was bedlam. Young men were rooting through boxes of camouflage fatigues. Nobody challenged Conrad for a moment. Half of them were barefoot and clad in nothing but boxer shorts, too. Although he couldn't find any socks or boots, he emerged from the building wearing a set of camouflage fatigues and even a camouflage cap. More incomprehensible bullhorns were bellowing away. Straight ahead was another parking area. Two young men jumped into jeeps and went screeling off, their headlights beaming deliriously through the rows of stricken barracks. Two jeeps had their headlights beamed in toward the center of the camp, apparently to provide some semblance of general illumination. Conrad drew closer and could hear the two jeeps idling. There were no drivers. The jeeps were just sitting there running. He walked up beside the closer one and looked inside. No keys. Nothing but a lever on the steering column. But of course. This was a military vehicle, and in the military, you couldn't afford to have keys floating around and getting lost or misplaced. But he wouldn't take this one. It was providing illumination, and its departure might be noticed right away. So he walked two rows back and picked out one. He tried the ignition lever, and just as he had deduced, that was all it took. The engine sprang to life. Slowly he pulled out of the row, turned on the headlights, and headed down the corridor between the rows of vehicles. Heading,
where?
His mind churned. To Pittsburgh? Back home to the Duet? Didn't dare. First place they would look. To Jill's mother's? She'd turn him in just like that. He knew that as well as he knew anything in the world. Minette, the lawyer? Had no idea where he lived. And he'd turn him in, too. Suddenly, as he neared the end of the row of jeeps, a pair of headlights beamed on, and a jeep pulled out right in his path.
Cutting me off, coming after me.
But instead of blocking his way, the jeep accelerated with a terrific roar and turned down the corridor, going away, spinning its wheels madly, sending up a tremendous geyser of dust, so that Conrad's headlights illuminated nothing but the roiling yellow cloud immediately in front of him.
"You lunatic!"
And in that instant, he thought of Kenny. The parking lot at Croker Global Foods. A beat pounding across the hard pan. A funnel of dust. A crazy skirl of electric guitars and a chorus of raw-throated young male voices screaming, "Brain dead! Brain dead! Brain dead!" A veritable tornado of dust lit up a feverish yellow by the floodlights. Kenny's outrageous boombox of a car fishtailing in the dirt and rocketing in beside his.
"Hey, Conrad!"
Kenny. The freezer unit came to work at 9 p.m. on Sunday nights. Kenny would be there at this moment. The warehouse was only 30 or 35 miles north of here. Kenny would think of something. Kenny would get word to Jill. Kenny would... The truth was, he didn't know what Kenny would do. He didn't even know if he was still working at the warehouse. Suppose they had changed his schedule. Suppose they dismissed the entire crew as soon as the earthquake hit. No, they wouldn't do that. They had emergency generators to protect the racks full of frozen product. Dom would have them working like dogs. On the other hand, suppose... The possibilities whirled about in his head. But there was no other possibility, was there? There was no one else he, Conrad Hensley, a fugitive from the Santa Rita jail, could turn to in the middle of the night in the aftermath of an earthquake. The yellow cloud began to clear as the jeep ahead of him reached the paved road out of the lot. It was tearing along at a terrific clip, apparently heading south toward the highway. Conrad sped along behind it. He glanced off to the side. Camp Parks appeared to be dancing in a madhouse of light beams and shadows. All in shock, the whole lot of them. The earth had risen up and shown them how helpless they actually were. Life was anchored by nothing at all. Near the bay, there was far less destruction, although electricity was out everywhere. The Croker Global Warehouse's immense hulk lay there in the darkness, inert, dead, barely discernible, seemingly deserted. They had shut down, sent everybody home. But in the parking lot, the lights of Conrad's jeep hit rows of cars, although not nearly so many as were usually there at this time of night. Now he could see a glow from one end of the vast black silhouette of the warehouse. The freezer unit, the backup generators, the light from the freezer spilled out onto the loading platform. Truck headlights came on at the other end. He could make out the ghostly shapes of several big white Croker Global trucks and hear the sighs of the air brakes. He cruised slowly up and down the rows of cars. He rounded the last row, and his headlights hit the cyclone fence, the razor wire, and cars and cars and cars and cars and... There! Thank God! He stopped the jeep and just let the lights stream over Kenny's ridiculous little low-slung boombox of a car. Then he nosed in beside it and turned off the engine and the lights and sank back into the seat. A terrible weariness came over him. His head seemed to drain. He was sweating profusely. His heart was beating so hard beneath his sternum, he could hear it when he opened his mouth. Tch, 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 tch. The veins on the backs of his hands were gorged with blood. His bare feet, which rested on the floorboards, were so sore and swollen. He closed his eyes and tried to think it all through. How could he get to Kenny? He couldn't very well just go walking into the unit. Everybody would recognize him. Dom, Lightbulb, Herbie, whoever was there. So he would wait for Kenny here. Wait for him to come back to his car. But suppose he stayed inside. Suppose Dom kept him in there overtime because of the emergency. Suppose Kenny didn't come out until the sun was up and the new shift started. How long did he dare stay out here in a U.S. Army vehicle, done up in battle camouflage? He was thirsty. Had to get something to drink. But how? So thirsty. Above all, thirsty. Had to think. He slid down and tried to stretch out and collect his thoughts. But his knees were sticking up, and suppose somebody saw them? So he rolled over on his side and jackknifed his knees. He pulled the cap down over his eyes for good measure. Let's see. Kenny and the freezer unit, and what could he get to drink? How could he call Jill and let her know what had happened? How could he find out about her and Carl and Christy? Strange movies were sliding by behind his eyelids. If Kenny was inside, and Dom was giving him instructions. Dom, grunting with great bursts of mouth fog, complaining about the tailgate parties over at Bolka. Kenny going, "Crash and burn!" And Lightbulb and the rest of them answering him in falsetto. Herbie brooding. Nick, the bald man with the necktie. Inside the cold, 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 icy cliffs.
"Eat shit, eat shit, eat shit, eat shit!"
Right beside the bunk. They'd broken into the cell, crying out, "Eat shit, eat shit, eat shit, eat shit!" Conrad rolled to slide down off the bunk. His knee hit the gear shift. He came to with a start. "Eat shit, eat shit, eat shit, eat shit!" from right outside the door of the Jeep. He propped himself up on one elbow and tried to make sense out of it. "Eat shit, eat shit, eat shit, eat shit!" The car right beside him roared in neutral, ready to shift into gear.
"Kenny!"
Conrad lifted himself high enough to look out the window. In the darkness, a silhouette, Kenny with his baseball cap and his bony Adam's apple, hunched forward in the driver's seat, his 20-inch boombox speakers yowling, battering the air with the anthem that had so infuriated Dom.
"Eat shit, eat shit, eat shit, eat shit!"
Conrad yelled out, "Kenny!
Eat shit, eat shit, eat shit, eat shit!"
No way Kenny could hear him. And now he was gunning the engine, ready to leave. Conrad scrambled toward the door. Kenny's car was backing up.
"Kenny! Kenny, stop!"
The crash and burner anthem,
"Eat shit, eat shit!"
filled the world. Now Conrad was out of the Jeep, screaming. But Kenny had his head turned to the rear as he backed up. In another second, he would be gunning his car through the dust of the parking lot, the way he liked to do. Only one way. Conrad ran toward Kenny's rakish red car and dove. He landed in a sprawl on the hood. The car came to such an abrupt stop that Conrad rolled right up under the windshield with his face flattened on the glass, staring head-on at Kenny, who was barely a foot away. Kenny stuck his head out his side window.
"The fuck? You crazy? You? In the army? In the middle of an earthquake? Jumping on the hood of my car? This I don't fucking believe!
Eat shit, eat shit, eat shit, eat shit!"
To Kenny, this was a great crash-and-burner adventure. He had Conrad follow him in the Jeep and abandon it in Northtown, up in Richmond, where its chances of being stolen, Kenny assured him, would be approximately 100%. Thereby obliterating the Jeep's recent history. At that point, Conrad got into the front seat of Kenny's little red boombox of a car and closed his eyes. Kenny told him why he was driving him to Oakland, but Conrad was too groggy to comprehend. His nervous system had sunk below the threshold of logic. His eyelids felt immensely heavy. A stupefying weight bore down on his cerebral cortex, driving him lower, 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 lower. Get word to Jill. But soon he couldn't think even about that. He didn't come to until lights and voices roused the sentinel, fear, deep in his nervous system. He opened his eyes. It was still dark. Kenny was cruising along a street with traffic and lights and voices. A wide street, four lanes. Sodium vapor lamps overhead. So many people, dark faces, out on the sidewalks, standing about in clusters in a park, treating themselves to a neighborhood beano in the aftermath of the greatest event of recent history, the earthquake.
Conrad turned toward Kenny. "Where are we?"
"O-Town," said Kenny, cackling. "Bump City, Shattuck Avenue, Oakland, California."
"Where are we going?"
Kenny laughed without explaining why.
"My's 24-hour mini-mart. You're going to meet my and my's army."
Kenny turned onto the asphalt apron of what looked like a service station. Lights beneath a shed-like roof shone down on two islands of self-service gasoline pumps. The sign over the entrance to the small building just beyond them said, "My's 24-hour mini-mart." The place was doing a lively business in the middle of the night, post-earthquake. Cars were backing out of the row of parking places on either side, and others were pulling in. With a sharp intake of breath, Conrad realized that Kenny was pulling into a spot right next to a police cruiser.
"Hey," said Kenny, "this is Shattuck Avenue, not Danville. You're going to see police cars. Just be cool. You can be sure there's no cops out on Shattuck Avenue in the middle of the fucking night looking for some white boy who's escaped from the Santa Rita jail."
Inside, Mize was a shabby space lit with fluorescent lights, so bright they made you wince. The place was crammed with racks of merchandise and glass-faced refrigerators full of every sort of soda, ice cream, milk, beer, and malt liquor imaginable, and stacks of cartons that had never been opened, and others that were empty and lying in jumbles on the floor. There were at least 24 customers in all, loose souls rolling around O-Town, Bump City, after an earthquake. Overhead, a battery of surveillance cameras, aimed at the entrance and down the aisles between the racks and toward the checkout counter and the cash register, recorded their jack-legged progress on videotape. From behind the register came the loud, angry voice of a woman.
"You a faggot, what you are! You look the boys! You be the girl!"
A contemptuous laugh.
"You don't care, they steal me everything! You a faggot!"
"Boosh it, my. I find it like that." With a sneer.
"You find a lot of dicks you look at, what you find. Now you go home, you fire."
"Come on, my. What I do to you?"
"You let them steal me everything! And you, look the pornos!"
Mai, the proprietress of Mai's 24-hour mini-mart, wore black jeans and a sleeveless black cotton blouse. She was a Vietnamese, no more than 30, with full, smooth Asian features, a glowing complexion, and full, sweetly curved lips. Not even anger could ruin such voluptuous good looks. The object of her scorn was a Chinese, a thin, almost gaunt boy in his mid-20s, wearing a knit golf shirt and jungle camouflage pants, like Conrad's, with what appeared to be a lock-blade folding knife in a pouch on one side of his belt, and a small, shiny flashlight in a holster on the other. Thoroughly cowed, he kept gesturing toward Mai and blurting out excuses. Kenny turned toward Conrad and grinned and winked. As my harangue continued, the nature of the offense became clearer. The Chinese, whose name was Hong, was supposed to manage the store whenever Maya was away or upstairs sleeping or working back in the office. But, as she now realized, if she was absent for any length of time, Hong liked to unscrew the hinges on the locked wooden cabinet that stored all the video surveillance equipment and watch pornographic tapes from the store's own rack on the monitor screens, thereby shutting down the entire surveillance system. Mai had been upstairs sleeping when the earthquake shook the city and had come downstairs to find a pornographic film rolling on her screens. All the cassettes were made for a heterosexual audience, but Mai was now convinced, or claimed to be, that Hong was homosexual and was interested only in the nude men with big dicks.
"Go yo home and be faggot,"
she was screaming at the hapless Chinese. In the background, enjoying it all immensely, was a group of 6 young men who had gathered at the far end of the counter,
One was a tall Chinese dressed like Hong, in camouflage fatigue pants. Two were Sikhs, with pale blue turbans and upswept beards and mustaches, both of them heavy-set and muscular. The other three had very dark skin and thin, fine-boned features. While Mai and Hong continued their set too, Kenny sidled over to Conrad and said out of the corner of his mouth,
"Ma's army. You see that guy, Hong?"
Hong was now insisting that he could prove he was not homosexual.
"And his buddy?"
He motioned toward the tall Chinese by the counter.
"They were both of them Chai Coms."
"They were what?"
"Chinese communists. Soldiers. They were born in Cambodia, and they speak Khmer, but they were trained in China. And they fought for China somewhere over here. And then they turned around and immigrated over here as Cambodians. You see that flashlight on his belt?"
He nodded toward Hong.
"That's aircraft steel. That's a weapon, bro. He could kill you with that thing."
Kenny was profoundly impressed and excited by lethal capabilities and the men who possessed them.
If only he really knew. "And you see that Sikh there, the tall one? His name is Torin Singh. He was a guerrilla in India, a sapper, is what he told me, fighting the government. And that black guy, the one on the left, his name's Achilles. He was a commando in Ethiopia and a paratrooper. But then they found out his old man had been a buddy of Haile Selassie, and so he went underground and finally got here. The other two, they're from Eritrea. You ever heard of Eritrea?"
Conrad shook his head.
"It's north of Ethiopia. The both of them, they were college students, and then they joined some revolutionary movement or whatever it was, and they were blowing up trucks and shit, and then they came here. These guys, they work nights at convenience stores, just like Hong does. They drive taxis at night, like Achilles. They work nights at the Pioneer Chicken, like Torin. I mean, you gotta be a commando or something to work nights at that damn Pioneer Chicken where he works. That neighborhood's worse than this one. And they all come here to Mai's. This is Mai's army. While everybody else sleeps, there's an army out here. There's sappers, guerrillas, tunnel rats, commandos, terrorists, volunteers for suicide missions. And I mean they're from Asia and Africa and God knows where else. And nobody knows how they got here, or what they want, or what they're really doing, or where they want to go. Except for Mai, maybe. This is where they come for fake IDs, fake licenses, fake social security cards, cell phone numbers, credit cards, green cards, plane tickets, jobs, whatever they need. These jobs don't pay shit. What does a guy like Hong make? Maybe $5 an hour. And they're dangerous. Working in these places is a good way to get yourself killed. But they're jobs all the same, and Mai'll keep you going. Mai's army."
Kenny's eyes were lit up with the romance of it all. The idea of a lethal foreign legion of the night, of young men hardened into a brotherhood of violence, a fraternity that Kenny, he who would make brain dead, eat shit, and crash and burn his anthems, so innocently admired. Conrad found such a vicarious thrill all too sad and deluded. In Conrad, these young men stirred an entirely different emotion. A wave of sadness came over him, and his heart sank. He saw seven pitiable creatures, young men torn up by the roots from all that means home and hearth and reassurance in this life, and blown halfway around the world to the bowels of Shattuck Avenue in Oakland, California. Seven young men, almost as hopelessly lost as himself. Mai turned away from Hong, shaking her head. Then she saw Kenny. She broke into a smile, and the loveliness of her wide, smooth face burst forth.
"Kenny! I think about you!"
"Hey, Mai," said Kenny. "Get off Hong's case and come here."
She came out from behind the counter, beaming. Kenny put one arm around her shoulders, and she put one arm around his waist,
and they gave each other a big squeeze. Three or four customers lined up at the checkout counter, waiting to pay for purchases, glowered. Mai looked up into Kenny's eyes and said,
"What happened up there? I worry about you."
Before he could answer, she turned her head around and gestured brusquely toward Hong with her free hand.
"Get back there! You don't see? You got customers!"
Forlornly, Hong trooped back around behind the counter to the register. To Kenny once more.
"So what happened?"
Kenny steered Mai toward the rear of the store. Conrad felt dizzy, nauseated, terribly weary, thoroughly conspicuous, and frightened. He was an escapee from the county jail, standing out in the middle of a convenience store at 3 o'clock in the morning in his bare feet. Muddy, swollen, bloody bare feet at that. The fact that he looked no worse than the rest of the loose souls who were up and around on Shattuck Avenue in Mai's 24-hour mini-mart in the wake of an earthquake seemed like no safeguard whatsoever. Now Mai and Kenny were heading back toward him. Mai's hips went this way and that way, ever so insouciantly, as she walked. "Okay," said Kenny. "Mai and me just had a talk. Here's what's going to happen. Mai's going to take care of you here tonight, okay? You're going to be fine. Mai's going to look after you. After you wake up, I'm going to come back, and I'm going to bring you some things. Got it?" He paused. He studied Conrad's face, and then his camouflage outfit, and then his feet. He looked at his feet a long time. "You want to know something?" Conrad stared back, dazedly. "You're a mess. What size shoes you wear?" He quizzed him about all sorts of sizes. Shoes, shirts, jackets, underwear. Then he said to Mai, "You got razors and shaving foam and combs and all that stuff here, right?" Kenny gestured toward the racks where the loose soles grazed in Mai's store, and Mai nodded yes. Kenny said to Conrad, "You're going to have a shave, old buddy. A big shave. You ain't going to have a mustache anymore. That's what you owe Mai for one night's lodging." "Okay," said Conrad, "I guess that makes sense. Look, one thing I've got to do is, I've got to get hold of my wife and let her know what's happened. Is there some way I could call her?" "I've been trying to reach Antioch myself," said Kenny. "You can't get through. All the lines are tied up. Plus, there's a relay station totaled in Concord. Besides, I'd be careful if I was you. They got automatic records of every call that's made."
"They do? Oh, yeah."
Conrad didn't know if this was some fantasy of Kenny's infatuation with soldiers, weaponry, surveillance, and espionage, or a real danger. He closed his eyes, lowered his head, and sighed deeply. It made him feel dizzy.
"You come with me," said Mai.
She laughed.
"Now you in Mai's army."
She led him back behind the counter to a tiny office. In the far corner were a narrow spiral staircase and the door to a cramped lavatory. Then she led him up the stairs, pausing at the top. A light came on. A few more steps, and the two of them were in a cramped attic space, beneath sloping eaves, that had been turned into a makeshift bedroom. Because of the steep slopes of the eaves, they could only stand in the center, side by side. He became aware of the jasmine perfume she wore. She pointed out two cramped, flimsy, upright cabinets. One served somehow as a shower, the other as a toilet.
"Okay, my friend," said Mai, "you take a shower."
"Thanks," said Conrad with another great sigh. "But I think I'm just going to lie down a minute." She laughed.
"Not just going to lie down. You a real mess, my little friend. You in Mai's army."
She gestured toward the mattress and the sheets.
"And that's Mai's bed. You take a shower, you feel better. Then you lie down."
She nodded a few times to indicate she meant business, then slipped past him to head back downstairs.
As he took off the camouflage uniform, his shadow swept grotesquely across the ceiling. He was a mess, sure enough. Mud was smeared over his chest, his midsection, his thighs, his knees. Mud had plastered his shorts to his groin. Chunks of dried mud fell to the floor as he took them off. His clothes were so filthy that after he took a shower and dried himself, he crawled into the makeshift bed with nothing on. He reached over and turned off the lamp on the floor. He lay there on his back. The sheets were redolent of jasmine. Soon his ability to reason began sliding helplessly away, and there was nothing but darkness, the drone of a fan, and a great fluffy cloud of jasmine. It was almost 11 a.m. by the time Conrad woke up, put on the plaid shirt, chinos, and construction boots that had materialized beside the bed, shaved off his mustache, per Kenny's instructions, and made his way downstairs to look for Mai. Sunlight was flooding in through the plate-glass windows of the mini-mart. Mai was out at the cash register, haranguing Hong, as usual. When she saw Conrad, she led him back into her little office, berating Hong for not taking her place at the register fast enough. She stood still for a moment and stared at Conrad's face.
"You look better," she said. "No more mustache!"
She laughed. This struck her as a very funny turn of events. Then she sat down at her desk, picked up the telephone, and ordered in some food. She had barely hung up when Kenny arrived. Conrad had never seen him look more manic. His pale blue eyes were electric. His grin showed all his teeth. He was carrying a navy blue duffel bag, heavy enough to bring out the huge muscles of his forearm. He flashed his wildest grin, for Conrad's benefit, stroked his own wispy blonde mustache with his thumb and forefinger, and said,
"You want to know something? You did yourself a favor. I never did like your mustache. Damn thing drooped. I'm not kidding."
"Look better," said Mai.
"You got it, Mai," said Kenny.
Then he set the blue duffel bag at Conrad's feet.
"Here's all the clothes you'll need, or everything I could think of."
He handed Conrad a newspaper and said,
"Take a look. You're on the front page."
Genuinely frightened.
"Me?"
A headline stretched all the way across the upper half of the Oakland Tribune. "Quake Rocks East Bay." From smaller headlines you quickly picked up, "Massive Destruction, 6.2 on Richter Scale, Hayward Fault." And there, just below the main headline, a big picture in color, must have been taken at dawn, of Santa Rita and the ruins of West Greystone and the escarpment that had risen beneath it and broken it almost in two. Above was a headline reading, "Jail Breaks." Below was a caption that began, "The quake's irresistible force created this cliff near Pleasanton, destroying an entire cell block at the Alameda County Jail. All the jail's buildings were heavily damaged. Rescue workers searched the ruins for survivors." Kenny said to Mai,
"You get the ticket?"
From a drawer in her desk, she produced an envelope and handed it to him. Kenny studied the ticket for a moment, then handed it to Conrad.
"Hang on to this. This is a ticket from Portland to Atlanta tonight at 10.
"Portland?
To Atlanta?"
"Portland'll be safer than Oakland or San Francisco, and Atlanta's where Mai can get things organized for you right away." Mai handed him another envelope, explaining that it contained the name, Lum Lock, of the Vietnamese who would meet him at the Atlanta airport and drive him to an apartment.
"How will we recognize each other?" asked Conrad.
"You not recognize him," said Mai. "He recognize you. Baggage area."
She reached into another drawer and pulled out one of what appeared to be a dozen apple-green baseball caps with yellow lettering outlined in dark green. The lettering said, "High Grow,
We feed gardens.
Lumlock, look for this hat. Social security card, driver's license, birth certificate. Whatever you want, he get it.
He's gonna want $750 cash, said Kenny.
Don't worry, you got it.
With that, Kenny stood up and removed a doubled-over envelope from the back pocket of his jeans. Here, count it. Astonished, Conrad did so. $500 bills, 12 50s, and 20 20s. $1,500 in all. He looked at Kenny with a baffled, wondering grin.
Good, said Kenny. I'm glad something makes you smile. You can pay me back when you got a condo in Danville, a Volvo station wagon with side-impact airbags, and a set of Fuzzy Zeller golf clubs.
Mai left the office to go out into the store, and Conrad went over to Kenny and said,
I hate to ask you to do anything more than you've already done, but could you try to call my wife? Maybe from a payphone someplace? Just tell her I'm okay. I'm out of Santa Rita, and I'll be in touch with her as soon as I can. You don't have to be any more specific than that. You don't even have to tell her who you are.
Kenny found a piece of paper and a ballpoint pen on Mai's desk and wrote down Conrad's telephone number in Pittsburgh and his own in Antioch and tore off his number and gave it to Conrad. 30 or 40 minutes later, Kenny and Mai introduced Conrad to the big, muscular Sikh, the Mai's warrior he had seen the night before, Torin Singh, who was about to make his regular truck run to Portland. They walked him out to the Sikh's huge rig, which he had pulled up to the curb out front on Shattuck Avenue. There were Sikh truck drivers all over California now, but Torin Singh, perched way up in the driver's seat of the silvery cab with his pale blue turban and an upswept beard as magnificent as the King of Diamonds's, looked like a monarch of the breed. Conrad turned to Kenny and smiled.
Kenny, I can't even begin.
Kenny cut him off.
Don't begin. I ain't even close to catching up. Just promise to send me a postcard when you get there.
What the hell do they have postcards of in Atlanta? Conrad climbed up into the cab, and the Sikh threw the engine into gear, creating the sort of roar Conrad had always disliked when he was working at Kroger Global Foods. Conrad leaned out the window and looked back and waved. The last thing he could see was two figures standing upright on the asphalt out by the gasoline pumps, one of them all bones and knobs and eccentric angles, wild-looking even in the abstract. The other one, Mother Earth in black jeans. Chapter 21 The Real Buckhead. As soon as the mayor came out of his little inner office and into the mayoral parlor, Roger Two White knew there was something different about him, but couldn't figure out what. He had on the same sort of nondescript dark gray suit as usual. True, he wasn't wearing a pizza grenade necktie this time. He had on a darkish red tie with a faint print design. But it wasn't the necktie. So what was it?
"Brother Roger," said Wes Jordan, giving him his customary mock high-five, and then gesturing for him to sit down on the couch.
Wes pulled up an armchair and sat across the coffee table from him. On top of the coffee table was a copy of today's Atlanta Journal-Constitution, with a color picture of something about yesterday's earthquake in California.
"Brother Wes," said Roger Two White, "you look different today, but I can't put my finger on what it is."
"I know. I'm leaner and harder. Either that or I have a better tailor now."
"You go to a tailor for those suits?"
"No, I'm only kidding," said the mayor. "No politician or lawyer should ever go to a tailor."
"Well, I'm a lawyer," said Roger Two White in an exaggerated tone of disappointment. "And I go to a tailor."
"I'm not too surprised. All those nipped-in waists and peaked lapels."
"Who do you go to?"
"A fellow named Gus Carroll. Has a little tailor shop down on Ellis." Well, said West Jordan, at least he's south of Ponce de Leon. Besides, you're not a litigator, are you? If you ever start going into the courtrooms, I'd advise you to buy off the rack like me.
What difference does it make? Said Roger Too White.
People can always tell there's something a little too studied, a little too smart, whereas charisma consists of being like everybody else.
Did you make that up?
Ah, somebody said it. I can't remember who. I just remember it was in Dr. Crawford's sociology class at Morehouse.
Anyway, said Roger Too White, there's something different about you. I just haven't quite figured it out.
The mayor shrugged and gestured toward the newspaper on the table. Did you read anything about this or see anything on TV?
Not really, said Roger Too White, looking down at the big color picture.
It was of an escarpment that had risen up out of the earth and torn a large wooden building in two, and twisted it every which way. The caption read, Natural-born jailbreak. A California earthquake measuring 6.2 on the Richter scale creates an instant cliff, demolishing the Alameda County Jail southeast of Oakland, and leaving a guard and 8 inmates dead. Another 20 inmates, as yet unaccounted for, may have escaped. With one of his familiar wry smiles, the mayor gestured toward the newspaper and said, Our press office has had about 2 dozen queries about the risk of an earthquake in Atlanta.
So what do you say? Asked Roger Too White.
So far as we can tell, there hasn't been an earthquake in this region in recorded history. The nearest geological fault line is somewhere in Tennessee. But we promise eternal vigilance. Makes me want to say all we've got here is a racial fault line. But I don't say that.
And its initials are FF?
Whose are?
The racial fault lines.
Ah, said the mayor, that is true. That is true.
And I presume that's why you asked me over?
There are many reasons why I enjoy your company, Roger, but in this instance, that is the case. That is the case.
Well, at least it hasn't hit the press.
Depends on how you define the press, said the mayor. Take a look at this.
He handed Roger a piece of paper.
At the top, in exaggerated oriental-looking letters, it said, Chasing the Dragon. Up in a square in the corner were the call letters of an internet website. Beneath that was the inscription, Opening the Doors of Perception. The rest of the page was presented as a news bulletin. Farik Fannin, a freaknik party, rape charges. It didn't mention Elizabeth Armholster by name, but the description of her unnamed father's industrial and social might was so detailed, down to the dollar volume of unnamed Armaxco, they might as well have supplied a picture of his house on Tuxedo Road and put an arrow over it.
God almighty, said Roger. Where the hell did this come from?
You know my press secretary, Gloria Loxley? Gloria came walking in with this. She just downloaded it from the internet. Then she started making some calls. Roger, people all over Atlanta are downloading this item from the internet.
Roger looked at it again. What the hell is Chasing the Dragon supposed to be?
It's sort of an internet gossip column, I guess you'd say. A lot of what they run seems to concern petty drug busts and drug availability on the street. Chasing the Dragon, so I'm told, is some new way of taking heroin without using a needle.
In other words, they're totally irresponsible, said Roger.
Totally unsavory, said West Jordan, but not necessarily totally irresponsible. Gloria checked out a couple of their drug arrest items with Eliu Yale at the police department, and they were right on the money. They just weren't big enough stories to make the Journal Constitution. What they're running about Fannin and the Armholsters, you'll notice, is accurate in every detail.
Roger looked at Wes with wide eyes, as if to say, What does this mean?
This doubles,
triples the pressure on the responsible media to break the story. They know people all over town are reading what you just read. They're dying to publish it, but they don't have anybody to attribute it to. They don't have anybody to confirm the rumor. Armholster hasn't filed charges because his daughters begged him not to. Because she's traumatized and won't even leave the house. Or that's what he told me. And as far as that goes, Armholster himself, he's petrified that his daughter's name will end up in the press. Meantime, he's going around trying to round up support behind the scenes for whatever retaliation he has in mind for your client.
Which will be what? Asked Roger.
I don't know, but he knows a lot of influential people. So I want to make sure your client has a fair shake when the time comes.
The mayor smiled again.
I know a lot of influential people myself.
Roger Two White didn't say anything. He just looked at Wes Jordan and waited and tried to figure out what it was that was different about him. He was aware of yet more Yoruba carvings mounted on the ebony walls.
"But that isn't what I wanted to see you about," said the mayor. "What I wanted to see you about is our man."
"Our man?"
"Our man, Charlie Croker."
"Ah," said Roger, tilting his head back in an ironic, mock-significant way. "What about him?"
"He's the one. No doubt about it. The 60-minute man. People used to point him out on the street and say, 'There's the 60-minute man.' I'm sure he knows precisely what pressures a big-time athlete is under. He knows how jealous and resentful people can be. He knows how fast people are to find fault with a sports star, and how they overinterpret every little thing. And the time to approach him is right, because this thing's going to blow wide open any moment." Roger knew there was a missing link in the logic of what Wes had just said, but he confined himself to a simple, "Uh-huh." "Oh, he's our man," said Wes, "but we've got one big problem. The man's practically bankrupt." "Yeah, he's about to lose everything he's got. They've already seized his corporate jet, a huge thing called a Gulfstream 5, big as an airliner. It won't have the same effect if he tries to stand up for Farik Fannin while he's going down in flames as just another megalomaniacal Atlanta real estate developer who didn't know enough to quit while he was ahead."
"Who seized his corporate jet?"
"Planners Bank."
"How do you know that?"
"Oh, I know a lot of what goes on at Planners Bank. I'm talking about the city. We keep a lot of our deposits, the municipal deposits, at Planners Bank. That's a huge asset for them. We're talking about millions of dollars a year they can lend based on those deposits. That's a huge asset. Believe me, they'll do a lot to keep us happy. And it's not just a matter of money. You remember we were talking the other day about the Atlanta way?"
"Uh-huh."
"Well, these big firms like Planners Bank, and the interesting thing is, the bigger they are, the more willing they are. They're willing to do us big favors just for the sake of, keeping everything smooth, warm, congenial, and well-oiled with the black power structure. It's sort of like paying tribute. Remember old Pomeroy? The historical sense in which he always used that term, paying tribute?"
"Uh-huh."
"That's one of the ways we keep ourselves busy in the city that's too busy to hate," said Wes Jordan with a classic Wes Jordan ironic smile.
"Maybe I'm slow or something, Wes," said Roger, "but I still don't get it."
"Roger, I'm speaking to you as a brother now, okay?"
"Okay."
"I have a delicate mission for you to perform," said Wes Jordan. Roger searched his face for a twist of the lips, a twinkle of the eyes, that would indicate that the phrase "delicate mission" was yet more Wes Jordan irony. But he looked completely serious and mayor-like.
"This is something," he continued, "that you mustn't tell your client about, or your colleagues, Mr. Salisbury and Mr. Pickett. Can I have your word on that?"
"I love you, Brother Wes, but I can't see how I could possibly give you my word, since I don't know what you're talking about."
"You can't even do that much for me, huh?" said Wes Jordan. "All right, then I'll just appeal to your sense of civic concern."
Roger searched his face once more. No smile, no wink, no arching of the eyebrows.
"This case," said the mayor, "has the potential to do more damage to this city than anything since the murder of Martin Luther King or the Rodney King riots, because it gets right down to the core of the white man's fear. Do you see what I'm saying?"
"Yes," said Roger Too White, "I can see that."
"All right. So what I'm saying is, I'm saying that Charlie Croker, or somebody like Charlie Croker, could be an essential figure to keep the city from getting split apart."
"Along the racial fault line," said Roger Too White.
"Exactly, along the racial fault line. Very well put. Along the racial fault line. So if he's willing to stick his neck out to that extent, and for somebody like him, this should really be sticking his neck out, this 60-year-old cracker with a... Did you know he has a 29,000-acre plantation down in Baker County?"
"No."
"Just for shooting quail? All very antebellum? Even got African-American servants who sing gospel for the guests after dinner?"
"You're exaggerating." He had started to say kidding.
"Not at all, not at all. He calls the place Turpentine. T-U-R-P-M-T-I-N-E. Originally, the cash crop at this place was not cotton, but turpentine, from the pine trees. Apparently, slashing the pine trees for resin was the worst work in the world. Much worse than picking cotton. Croker seems to enjoy calling them the Turpentine niggers."
"Oh, come on. And you think you're going to get him to stand up for Farik Fannin against Inman Armholster?"
"I have my reasons for thinking he might. And if he does, then I think the city would owe him a debt of gratitude, which might take the form of removing some of the other pressures that now bear down on the man."
"Such as?"
"Such as the threat of bankruptcy, to be specific. I would think that Planners Bank would find it in its long-term interest, as a part of this city, to restructure the man's debt load in some significant fashion, so that in the same moment he speaks up for your client, he isn't revealed to be one of the biggest deadbeats in the history of commercial real estate in Atlanta."
Roger Too White pondered all this for a moment. He wasn't sure what he was actually hearing.
"All right, Wes, assuming all that makes sense, which I'm not sure it does, I don't see where I would fit in. I need someone to outline the facts of the matter to Croker. It can't be me, because that might be misinterpreted. But if it comes from your client, from counsel representing your client, then it's perfectly appropriate. You're not asking him to testify in court. All you're doing is asking him to render a judgment in the arena of public opinion. We're not talking about the law. We're talking about public relations."
"But what kind of opinion, Wes? What kind of opinion could you possibly expect Charlie Croker to have, or express?"
"That Farik is a fine young man. That young athletes like him have always been set-ups for all sorts of pressures, schemes, and vilifications. That he can't believe that Farik is guilty of the sort of thing he's being smeared with now, and so forth and so on."
"Where's he going to do this?" asked Roger. "At a protest demonstration, or a rally, or what?"
"No, no, no, no," said Wes. "You don't have protests or rallies in a sex case. What I envision is a press conference. A press conference whose ostensible purpose is simply to urge calmness and restraint in the face of a potentially explosive situation. In the course of that, I establish the point that men have rights, too. Even big black men. Even big black sports stars. every bit as many rights as white women half their size. This is all in the context of maintaining public order, you understand. Then Croker gets up and makes the point even stronger. He says that Farik is a fine young man.
Wait a minute, Wes, said Roger. He's going to say Farik is a fine young man? On the basis of what?
I wonder if he's ever even laid eyes on Farik, unless it was from a seat in the grandstand.
Wes Jordan smiled.
He has to meet Farik, Roger, and get to know him. And as you know him is to love him. Roger let loose a laugh that ended up sounding like a snort.
For God's sake, Wes, you and I can't stand the son of a bitch.
I think you might be surprised, Roger, said Wes Jordan with a familiar ironic gleam in his eyes. I think you might be surprised. I think Mr. Croker might see something in Farik that we don't see.
Well, where's he supposed to meet him?
I'll leave that to your best judgment, Counselor. But it's essential that he meet him and that he come away from that meeting ready to say favorable things about Farik, for the record. It's also essential that he know that you, as a representative of Farik and his many supporters, are in a position to see to it that the banking interests in this city restructure his loans on highly favorable terms so as not to damage his credibility at this pivotal moment in Atlanta's history. And if he says, "Why me?" then you say, "Because you're the only Atlanta business leader with a sports career like Farik's. You're the 60-minute man." Now Roger gave the mayor an ironic smile of his own.
And he's supposed to believe all that because some black lawyer he's never heard of drops by and tells him his troubles are over?
I already thought of that, said the mayor. I think what you have to do is offer him a practical demonstration, a sort of field experiment, as it were. I think what you have to tell him is, go see Farik and then decide if you want to do your part for the city at the press conference. And if you say yes, then all communication from Planners Bank concerning outstanding loans will immediately cease. I think Mr. Croker will look upon you as a black prophet he can believe in.
And you really think you can see to that? Asked Roger.
If I can't, then the field experiment will be a failure. But I'm not worried. Wes Jordan leaned back in his chair and thrust his chest out in a certain satisfied way, as if he had already won a great battle. The ironic smile that Roger had known for so many years played upon his lips.
"Roger, you're about to see the way politics actually works in a city. It would be nice to think that certain laudable positions prevail because they have an irresistible logic all their own. But that is seldom the case, seldom the case. And I'm sure the Charlie Crokers of this town, dense though they may be in certain respects, already understand that."
Roger sat bolt upright on the couch, opened his eyes wide, and flashed a big grin.
"I figured it out."
"Figured out what?"
"What's different? About you?"
"Really? You gonna let me in on it, too?"
Roger Two White slapped the side of his leg and grinned some more and started laughing.
"You're darker, Brother Wes. You're darker. What did you do? How'd you do it?"
The mayor ran his hands over his own cheeks, as if in wonderment.
"Darker? Well, I'll be damned. It is true that I've gotten in a lot more golf than usual."
"Golf?"
"Been playing a lot of golf recently, Brother Roger."
"You? Give me a break, Brother Wes."
"Yeah, I know, I used to make fun of golf. But I figured I ought to get outdoors more, smell the newly mown grass and the newly raked sand traps. Lanny's been playing, too."
"Lanny? Your wife Lanny? You must be joking."
"No, I'm not joking," said Wes Jordan. "Everybody's entitled to change his or her mind. The good old Georgia sunshine does wonders for a person."
"Well, you sly old dog, you," exclaimed Roger Two White. "You're getting a suntan for the election campaign.
You're getting darker.
West Jordan winked and chuckled deep in his throat. It just naturally happens to us golf lovers. Just naturally happens. And besides, everything is relative. I've always been blacker than thou, Roger Two White. Peepgas told people he lived in Buckhead. But this was Buckhead. This was the real thing. At the wheel of his little Ford Escort, he had just turned off West Paces Ferry Road onto Valley Road, on which, less than a quarter of a mile from this point, according to Martha Croker, he would come upon her house. Peepgas was all eyes. Rolling lawns, absolutely perfectly cut, watered, landscaped, and ornamented by flowers and deep green bushes, every leaf of which seemed waxed and polished by hand. Rolling lawns swelled up on either side of Valley Road, leading to stupendous piles of Georgian brick with real slate roofs or romantic but equally stupendous villas of Italianate stucco atop the crests. And even though it was 9 o'clock in the morning, on a hot day in May that had already turned the asphalt slopes of Collier Hills into an oven, here in the real Buckhead, all was serene and green and cool, thanks to the soaring trees, left over from virgin forest, that created a great green canopy for the entire neighborhood. Peepgas slowed down, as much in awe as in the interest of spotting Martha Croker's house number. The house numbers seemed to be mainly on mailboxes at the foot of the driveways. In a neighborhood like this, if you actually put the number on the house, no one would ever see it. It would be too far away from the road. The street itself, Valley Road, was laid out in suitably wasteful serpentine curves, like the floor of a valley winding its way between the eminences of the castles that rose up on either side. Peepgas drove his little escort around a big bend, ever so slowly, and there, in the middle of the street, women, 6 or 8 of them, walking right in the middle of the road, at a leisurely pace, laughing, talking. Black and Latin women of various ages, but none very young, some in dresses, some in blouses and pants and sneakers, walking right in the middle of Valley Road. In the next instant, it dawned on Peepgas. Maids, housemaids, for the castles. They arrived by bus, on the line, the number 40 line, that ran along West Paces Ferry Road, got off at the corner of Valley Road, and walked the rest of the way to the castles, which were their places of employment. There were no sidewalks in this part of Buckhead. Who other than servants would be walking anywhere anyway? And they had to walk in the street. But why out in the middle? Peepgas swung way over to the left and passed them, very slowly. Only one or two of the women even bothered to look his way. Just ahead he saw Martha Croker's house number on a mailbox by the driveway. And up the driveway, at the crest of the great swollen green lawn, Peepgas couldn't believe it. The house was a colossal pile of brick with a portico and white columns and windows with white muntins that seemed 10 feet tall. It took Peepgas's breath away. He suddenly felt terribly intimidated. "Jesus Christ," he thought, "I can't drive up to that place in a 5-year-old Ford Escort." So he continued past the driveway and made a U-turn. Plenty of room on Valley Road to make a U-turn in a Ford Escort, and headed back the other way. Now he had to pass the battalion of maids by swinging to the right. More of them gave him the once-over this time, no doubt wondering what he was doing. Once he passed them, he made another U-turn and pulled over to the curb about 50 feet from Martha Croker's driveway. Now plenty of the women had turned their heads around to give him a dubious look. Who was this creep who kept driving by them, and was now getting out of his car so he could follow them, on foot,
out in the middle of the street.
He'd walk up her driveway, escortless. That's what he'd do.
He'd soon discovered why the maids walked out in the middle of the street. On the edges, the street sloped so much to allow for water to run off. Walking was uncomfortable. So now, out in the middle of Valley Road, came a battalion of maids, with Raymond Peepgas of Planner's Bank bringing up the rear. Martha Croker's driveway was also laid out in yet more graceful, wasteful buckhead curves. On either side were banks of green and white-striped hostas. So this is what Croker had to give up when he shucked Martha, thought Peepgas. He was beginning to get a bit winded from the long climb. His armpits were already cooking. This, in turn, made him think of how second-rate his clothes were. This old gray pinstripe suit that had come back just a bit shiny from its last trip to the cleaners, the buttonhole in the front that was frayed and needed salvaging, this striped shirt that was beginning to get a bit threadbare where the collar met the necktie, and the necktie, which suddenly seemed far too loud to be wearing into a house like this. You had to walk up 3 steps to the portico and pass between 2 great white Doric columns to reach the front door, which was a colossal thing, painted dark green, with all